And time now for sports. Last night, the stars at night were big and bright. You know where.
The Texas Rangers are the 2010 American League champions.
And in a stroke of poetry, they struck out Alex Rodriguez, who left the Rangers for the Yankees to get that last out. The Texas Rangers going to the World Series, their first in team history. They beat the Yankees 6-1 at the ballpark in Arlington last night. Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine was there, joins us from Dallas. Morning, Howard.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So how did a team that went through a bankruptcy filing in August beat the Yankees and get into the World Series? This is great.
Well, by beating the Yankees like a drum, that's how. I mean, they went out, and certainly this series went six games, but it really wasn't close at all. They outscored the Yankees 38-19. They were up 5-0 in the first game and ended up losing that game. And then when everyone thought their knees were going to be shaking going into the great mystique of New York, they shut them. They beat them 7-2 in game two, 8-0 in game three, 10-3 in game four, and then 6-1 last night. And the Yankees scored their only run on a wild pitch. And so the knees were not shaking at all. The Yankees looked old. They looked slow. And this young upstart team with the manager, Ron Washington, who was a losing streak away from getting fired after testing positive for using cocaine last year. They stuck together. The MVP, Josh Hamilton, had his own drug and alcohol addiction problems for years. And as they said, they stuck together as a team, and they believed in each other and all of those other sports cliches, and they demolished the Yankees in a pretty stunning six games.
Let's just note, the top four starting pitchers for Texas make $13 million combined.
That's right.
That's less than CC Sabathia's salary alone.
The Yankees' payroll is $206 million. The Texas Rangers' payroll is $55 million. And that gives you a little bit of an idea of how much of at least of a financial upset this might have been. And sure, there was a great deal of poetry last night, because I think that the people in this town, and especially at the stadium last night, were more excited that they finished it with the $252 million man, Alex Rodriguez, to strike him out. to end the playoffs for the Yankees was poetic, to say the least.
Who do you see in the Phillies-Giants series that continues tonight? Giants are ahead 3-2.
Well, I think that the Giants can win a game in Philadelphia. And if not, then the Phillies are certainly going to be very worthy of winning, because they're only hitting .214 going into these last two games. I think the Giants are going to win. I think you're going to have the San Francisco Giants, who have never won a World Series since arriving in San Francisco in 1958, and the Texas Rangers, who have never won a World Series, obviously, since coming here in 1972. So I think somebody's going to win for the first time, and what fun that'll be for them.
Yeah, well, for yes, absolutely, and for us, too.
But
look,
not for you, Scott.
No, and Joe Girardi, former Cub, made some very questionable pitching choices as Yankee manager, and it's the ex-Cub factor, right?
Always.
I have to ask you about football, because you're apparently preparing a piece where you say a number of recent events could mean the end of pro football as we know it.
Well, you've got this collision, no pun intended, between whether people would watch this sport when you take the violence out of it. The sport has lost its moral legitimacy right now because you've got critical mass. This sport, you cannot name another sport where paralysis is a routine risk. It's not a question of whether or not the players are taking the risk on their own. It's simply the fact that we know that this sport is unsafe. We know that driving a car without a seatbelt, we know the risk involved, but that doesn't mean that you're allowed to do it. This sport is in a lot of trouble, and we all thought it would be performance-enhancing drugs that did it. It's actually safety and concussions that are bringing this sport to a real confrontation with itself, and I'm sure Congress will get involved very soon.
Well, Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. I'm a dunce. I know a few song lyrics, a few baseball stats, and how to knot a tie. Left to my own devices, I confused Doric with Corinthian, Monet, Manet, and Matisse, Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, Socrates and Sophocles, Crete and Sicily, Grover Cleveland and William Howard Taft. Hey, the capital of Missouri, Columbia, right? Or is it Branson? But my ignorance is carefully concealed on this program because I can punch four digits on the telephone and hear...
Library, can we help you?
That's Guy Maleski, who is the source of all human knowledge. I said that on the air once. It's all I have to know. She's NPR's longest-serving librarian. She was the inspiration for a PBS children's special. She's now written a book that harvests some of the facts that she's plucked so lovingly over the years. The book is All Facts Considered, the Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Guy Maleski joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scooter.
Now, watermelon, fruit, or vegetable?
Yes. It's both. Most of us would think of it as a fruit, but it can also be considered a vegetable because it's in the same family as cucumbers and gourds. And the state legislature of Oklahoma a few years ago decided that it would be their state vegetable.
But in theory, could California decide to make it a state fruit?
Oh, absolutely.
Huh. The rocket's red glare. Where'd the red glare come from?
Well, that's Congreve rockets,
yeah.
Which was at that point in time, early 1800s, a new development in weaponry. Mm-hmm. And to get a better idea of what they are, if you've ever set off a bottle rocket in your backyard on 4th of July, that's a small version of a Congreve rocket.
We really can't stump you with anything, can we?
Well, not if it's in my book. Then I've already looked it up.
All right. Well, I think the question everybody wants to know, what's it like to work with a group of insufferable egos like you do, day in and day out?
I can't imagine who you're referring to.
I can't either, but objectively, you know. Yeah.
Well, I would say if you're
in the abstract, what's it like to
work NPR hosts and reporters? I'm very happy to support them because for the most part they're very appreciative of our efforts. But I wouldn't want to be your editors.
What does that mean?
I wouldn't want to have to tell you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think almost the most astonishing fact, and I hardly consider it inessential, that I encountered in your book is, you know, all of our latte swilling in this day and age to the contrary. Americans are actually drinking less coffee than we did in 1946, right?
According to the USDA, Americans in 2007 consume about 22.7 gallons, whereas in the 1940s it was more than twice that. And I think no doubt the difference is the popularity of carbonated beverages, soft drinks and the like, which were not so available earlier in the 20th century.
Yeah, we just had a couple, right?
So everybody drank coffee at every meal.
Some of us still do. I thank you to recognize.
Yes.
One of the last things that our friend, the late Dan Shore, wrote for publication was a blurb for your book. He said, Guy Maleski enshrines the humble fact in a way that's both instructive and enchanting. Any memories?
Well, I remember the first time Dan came into the library was pretty much my very first day in the news library in 1990, and he expected to see the library manager, Rob. Rob wasn't there. He stopped short. I said, hello, can I help you? He said, no, that's okay. And he turned around and walked out. But once he realized...
I meant any warm memories.
Oh, no, it gets better.
Yeah.
Once he realized that I was going to be the only librarian available on Fridays and he needed information on Fridays, he did go ahead and ask me some questions and I managed to answer them adequately. And so we did become very close friends. And I'm really very proud that he read my book, that there's a fact about him in my book, and that he wrote me that blurb.
Is that the Watergate fact?
That's right. He asked me to find the phrase, follow the money, in the book, All the President's Men by Woodward and Bernstein. And because it's Dan Shore and my policy is to go to any length to get Dan Shore the information he needed, I went through the book page by page. And that phrase does not appear there. And then in talking to Bob Woodward and to the screenwriter, William Goldman, Dan discovered that it's actually kind of made up for the movie and it did not occur in real life. So I called that fact, he should have said it.
But people say it all the time to each other.
Well, now they do, certainly. And that's why Dan was asking. He wanted to use it in another context.
Did Van Gogh cut off his ear?
In the United States, it's okay to say Van Gogh. It's okay. What we're most used to, but it's nice of you to try.
Yeah. I wouldn't do it for anyone other than you, I assure you.
There are a couple of German scholars who recently looked at the police reports and such and think that perhaps his good friend, the painter Paul Gauguin, cut off his ear on the street in Arles when they were arguing over something. But apparently,
Excuse me. If he cut off his ear, he can't be that good a friend.
Well, no. They were having a bad day.
Yeah.
But they were friends over many, many years. But the curator of the Van Gogh Museum is skeptical. So I put it in there as just a maybe.
I think I know this, but let me double check it with you. Who was the first non-Native American to set foot in Chicago?
Well, it was actually an African man, a man from Haiti, whose name was Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable, and he constructed the first dwelling at a trading post at what is now known as Chicago.
Yeah, and they named a high school after him, although we say it Du Sable.
Of course.
Don't have
in New York we would say Du Sable. Du Sable.
I will say, while we're recording this interview, that what we treasure about you here, you just don't wait for the phone to ring. You find out stuff and bring it to our attention. I mean, you know, so many of the stories that people wind up hearing that they actually like begin with you uncovering something.
Well, in any of the librarians, we read all the time. We're constantly looking at news sources, at websites, at all kinds of things that are happening in the world. And a particular host or reporter pops into mind and say, oh, so-and-so needs to know about this. So we're all very proactive. It's really a part of the proper job of a librarian.
So sometimes on those very rare occasions when we call up the extension of the library and there's no answer, it goes into voicemail. Am I correct in assuming that there are half a dozen of you crouching below the table saying...
Oh, no, it's Scott. You pick it up. We're happy to answer any call.
You have a wonderful last section where you talk about great endings to books, including, I think, just about my favorite, which is Frank McCourt's ending to... I like The Great Gatsby, too.
That is the line that makes it the great American novel, I think.
Yeah.
It's the closing line.
Born carelessly against the past.
So we beat on, boats against the current, born back ceaselessly into the past.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And then you have Frank McCourt's ending from Angela's Ashes.
I stand on the deck with the wireless officer, looking at the lights of America twinkling. He says, "My God, that was a lovely night, Frank. Isn't this a great country altogether?" "Tis." All of these closing lines, which I thought was very clever of me to use that as the final fact in the book, all of them are ones that I'm so attached to, I can't even read them without choking up. Some of them I absolutely can't even read to myself without choking up.
Well, so. NPR's reference librarian, Kim Maleski, her new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Key, it's a great book. I'll say it. Tis.
Thank you so much.
And you can find out how many insects are on Earth and their names and read more of Key's favorite facts at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. New flare-ups this week in the foreclosure crisis. Bank stocks got beaten up after word spread of pressure on lenders to buy back billions of dollars of questionable loans. And coming up, we'll talk to Joe Nocera of the New York Times about the fallout over allegedly fraudulent paperwork in thousands of foreclosure cases. But first, NPR's Chris Arnold reports on the efforts of consumer groups who argue that banks have also been deficient when it comes to helping homeowners avoid foreclosure.
Ever since these foreclosure paperwork problems came to light, the banks have said that they haven't been taking houses from anybody who shouldn't really be foreclosed on. But regulators and housing advocates say that's not actually true.
They are foreclosing on people who could and should be able to stay in their homes.
Mike Calhoun is president of the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending. He says the banks aren't just making big mistakes with foreclosure documents.
The same companies who are messing up this paperwork are the ones who administer the foreclosure prevention programs, and there's lots of evidence that they're messing that up as well.
It was just so frustrating. I'm talking on a daily basis.
In the state of Maine, Nancy and John Longvall say that they've been struggling for the past 2 years to work with their lender, City Mortgage. They say one day they'd be told that they qualify for help under a government program that would lower their mortgage payments. Then they'd be told that they don't qualify. They say they've faxed in documents, the bank has lost them.
They would tell us we needed this paperwork. This person would say, no, you don't need that. We have that.
What am I supposed to do? I can't get any answers.
Nancy says after a while, she started losing her temper and yelling at the call center workers.
People can only take so much. And a couple of times I've had them scream at me.
Really? I mean, the call center person would be screaming at you and you'd be screaming at them?
Yeah.
And I said, what are you doing? Just hang up. I said, you don't have to listen to that nonsense. I don't. You are.
John Longvall is a former construction worker. The couple bought their house back in 2004. They're grandparents now, and they wanted a house with some land around it, with space for the whole family, and they could afford that. They put down 20% and paid the mortgage for 4 years. Then they both lost work during the recession. But they still did have some income, enough, their housing counselor says, that they absolutely should qualify for a loan modification to let them keep their home. So John Longvall says it's been really hard to be in limbo for these past 2 years.
This is our dream. This is our retirement, supposedly. And at this point right now, everything that we own, dreams and all, are gone if this does not work.
City Mortgage says they are working with thousands of homeowners to help them stay in their houses, and the Longvalls do appear to be on the verge of finally getting a loan modification. But because of problems like this, the state of Maine has started what's called a mandatory mediation program.
So here in Maine, we have a mediation process.
Housing counselor Jennifer Haberin-Gordon explains that the idea is to cut through all this back and forth with the call centers and lost documents. If the homeowner requests it, the mortgage company has to provide a representative to sit down with the homeowner, their counselor, and a third-party mediator. The mediator collects all the relevant documents before the meeting, and they can see then if the homeowner qualifies for an offer for a more affordable loan payment.
So you have a day and a time where you can meet with all of those parties, with somebody with decision-making ability. Can you make me an offer, and what is that offer, and get the terms of that offer that day? You may get a permanent modification offered that day.
And it turns out that these efforts have been working really well. The state of Connecticut has a similar effort that's been up and running a little longer and is proving to be an effective backstop for homeowners who are told that they don't qualify for loan modifications. Roberta Palmer heads up that effort for the Connecticut court system. She says most homeowners take advantage of this, and a majority of them, 63%, end up getting to stay in their houses.
When it's done well, it really makes a huge impact.
Mike Calhoun with the Center for Responsible Lending says that this is one of the top priorities for housing advocates right now. He's been in meetings with senior government officials this week to push them to adopt a similar mediation requirement nationwide. He thinks that could help hundreds of thousands of people avoid foreclosure. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Supporters of the Homestar legislation say that energy-efficient homes would save money and reduce this nation's carbon footprint. People do like saving money, but there's debate about whether humans are responsible for global warming. Now, that might seem to be a 21st century political issue, but the matter of greenhouse gases goes back to the 1800s in the work of French scientist Joseph Fourier. Weekend Edition's math guy Keith Devlin is here to give us a little climate change history from the mathematical point of view. He joins us from Stanford University. Keith, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be here again.
And how did Monsieur Fourier begin to think about this?
So he was thinking about the following rather interesting question. He said, every day the sun's rays strike the Earth's surface and they warm it up. So why doesn't the planet just keep getting hotter and hotter until it's the same temperature as the sun? Well, the answer, of course, as he realised, was that the heat must be carried out into space. There must be some invisible infrared radiation, we'd call it today. Mm-hmm. Well, he used mathematics to calculate that cooling effect, and he got a temperature of the surface of the Earth that was much colder than the Earth really is. So he realised that something must be keeping the heat in. The only thing that was possible was the atmosphere. So he said, the atmosphere keeps the heat in the surface. And he compared it to heating up the air inside a glass box. He didn't actually talk about a greenhouse. He talked about a glass box and said, when you heat up the air in a glass box, the heat remains in the box.
And what kind of math did he use to make these calculations?
Fourier approached the problem by thinking about heat radiation as a radiation process. It's a wave process. So he developed mathematics that allows us to understand the way things radiate through radiation, how they are transmitted through radiation. Now, he was thinking of heat radiation. Mm-hmm. But once you have mathematics that studies heat radiation, you can use that same mathematics to study other kinds of radiation. You can apply that mathematics to light waves or to sound waves.
So we've known about the greenhouse effect for 150 years.
We have, almost 200 years. The correct physics was worked out about 150 years ago, in 1862, in fact, by an Irish physicist called John Tyndall. He was doing experiments in his laboratory, and he discovered that water vapour, and in particular carbon dioxide, don't allow heat to pass through them. That means that if you have any carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, heat is not going to be able to pass through it. So he gave us the correct explanation of why the atmosphere keeps the heat in. The more carbon dioxide you have in the atmosphere, the less able the heat is to escape, and the more the Earth's surface will get warmer and warmer.
Well, Keith, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure, Scott, and try to keep cool.
not a problem this time of year for the moment. Our math guy, Keith Devlin, out at Stanford, and this is NPR News. Joined now by our friend from the world of business, Joe Nocera, who's in New York. Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
And thanks for having me, Scott.
Joe, Bank of America says it reviewed all the foreclosure affidavits in question, and the facts in them were accurate.
That's right. They reviewed 102,000 affidavits in 3 weeks.
Can they do that?
That's pretty good work. That's pretty short work, don't you think, Scott?
Well, I'm impressed. And does it suggest something to you?
Well, it suggests to me that they would like to foreclose a little bit faster. They're basically claiming that the underlying facts are that the homeowners in these cases have not been making their payments and ought to be foreclosed on. They're probably right about that. The problem that they face is it the Bank of America that owns the properties and has the right to take them back? And that's what this affidavit scandal has been all about. It's not just, somebody signing a bunch of documents without looking at the underlying paperwork. It's how real is the paperwork? And what happened, Scott, is that during the era of the bubble, when all these loans were being sold to Wall Street and passed around to investors and going from one hand to another, it really kind of became confusing about who owned what. So the banks really need to start proving that they own these properties that they want to reclaim.
And does Bank of America have the legal standing to simply say these affidavits are legitimate and then move on to foreclosure?
It depends on a lot of things. There are certain places where the judicial system has basically saying, we don't trust you guys anymore, and you have to prove you have the underlying documentation in every single case. There are other judges in other districts who are so overwhelmed by the sheer caseload here that all they want to do is look at the affidavit and send it through, which just adds to the general unfairness of the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. The general unfairness being?
The general unfairness being, people who might have a legitimate claim that the bank doesn't really have the right to take over the property will lose the property. And in other cases, it will get a good, strong look by a judge. I was just going to say, this is not an issue of a legal technicality, Scott. They said this is just a technicality. These people really should lose their homes. But there is this thing called due process. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like saying, well, if you've committed a crime and I saw you do it, we don't even need to have a trial because you're obviously guilty. And you can't really do that in this country.
Let me ask you about this other legal challenge. And these are large investors, including the Federal Reserve, who say they want to sue the Bank of America unless they pay them back for loans that were backed by mortgages that allegedly violated their underwriting standards.
Right. This is a mounting issue as investors begin to organize and begin to kind of fight back. It's very simple. When an investor buys a bond that have underlying mortgage loans, there's also an agreement that basically say that those loans conform to certain standards. And what these investors are now saying is these loans did not conform to standards. They were terribly underwritten. They were problem loans. And therefore, the bank should be forced to buy them back. And so what you're going to see, Scott, I think, is a rising movement by the investment community, the owners of the mortgages, saying to the banks, we want you to buy these loan backs, and it's going to be a brutal, long, drawn-out war in the courtrooms.
That can't be good for business.
It's not good for anybody. It's not good for the courtrooms, for that matter. everything that clogs up the system like this, both in the foreclosure area and in this buyback area, makes it harder for the country to come out of the economic difficulty that we're in, makes it harder for home prices to stabilize, makes it harder for the real estate market to rebound, which we all desperately want and need to happen.
Jonas Herra writes the Talking Business column for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.